So I just mentioned school attendance there. And Tuusula has sent warning letters to nearly 3,000 parents, just under 3,000. This is in the past 7 years, for not sending their children to school enough. If you go on to Tuusula's website, they have advice for reporting absenteeism. So under the Education Welfare Act of 2000, schools are obliged to submit a number of reports and notifications that relate to poor school attendance. The poor school attendant needs to be responded to early. Otherwise, as research has shown, it can lead to poorer exam results, no surprise there, early school leaving, unsuccessful transfer from primary, and poorer life chances for children. So if you look to some of the details here, school returns, so the schools report all students who have been absent 20 days or more by submitting student absence reports twice a year. Then there's the annual attendance report. That reports the total numbers of days lost through absence by submitting it at the end of the academic year. Education welfare referrals, that's where a school principal has a concern in relation to the school attendance of a pupil. Reduced school day notifications since the 1st of January 2022. All students who are on a reduced school day must be notified. And then expulsions and suspensions. Schools are obliged to notify Tuusula where there is an intention to expel a pupil, and also must notify them where the expulsion has been confirmed. Also, the Citizens Information website has some details in terms of school attendance. It says here that the legislation governing attendance in Ireland is the Education Welfare Act, as I mentioned. So under the Act, the minimum school leaving age is 16 years in Ireland, or until students have completed 3 years of second level education, whichever is later. And I know that independent TD Dennis Nocton has said that social welfare recipients should get their social welfare cut if their children are not attending school. I'm now joined to discuss this by Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, that is Tanya Ward. Good afternoon to you, Tanya.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
First thing I want to ask you is, what do you think about TD Dennis Nocton's comments?
Look, I wouldn't support them. And to be honest, the research would show something like that wouldn't really work in this situation. I think plunging people into poverty isn't really going to help with this particular situation when it comes to school attendance. But look, I share his frustration when it comes to, and there are some situations where parents are struggling to get their children to school or to see the value of school sometimes. But often there can be other issues behind why a child isn't attending school. What always concerns me is that when you hear there's reports done of children in the childcare court, so when Tuusula is going to take a child into care, and you'll often hear it as part of the story is the child hasn't been in school for 2, 3 or 4 months. It's always deeply concerning to hear that, because not only is the child not in school, but obviously there's a very serious reason why Tuusula has had to take the child into care. And I suppose if you think of those situations, I think cutting someone's welfare payments probably isn't going to address the underlying reason why the child isn't going to school.
Now, I mentioned nearly 3,000 parents in the past 7 years have received warning letters from Tuusula for not sending their children to school enough. We found out these figures according to Freedom of Information, and we note here 232 school attendance notices were issued in 2021. Tanya, just a couple of days ago I was speaking with the Irish Second Level Students Union, and it was about the Leaving Cert results date, which is still yet to be confirmed. And they were noting, obviously, now with COVID-19 and the same as for the Leaving Cert 2021, there was a second chance to resit your paper, you know, if you had been infected with COVID-19. Another one of those reasons is for things like mental health issues, grief reasons, bereavements, etc. When it comes to 20 days out of the year, with say if a student is ill for some reason and they are also dealing with maybe mental health issues or a bereavement or something, where is the line drawn there in terms of absenteeism? Would that still count with the 20 days, and then any parent still would be contacted even if it was for specific reasons, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, they do take account of illnesses, and to be honest, my own children missed more than 20 days because of COVID, because the class, I guess, I'm getting shut because some of them, the class had COVID. And I know, for example, in the last year, the last 2 years, TUSLA has had a very careful approach in relation to this, because, as I say, the registers aren't really telling them the story, because there has been so much absence from school for children across the board because of school closures, because of an outbreak. So you'll find that, TUSLA doesn't take action against parents because a child is sick. Generally what they'll do is, if the education welfare officer has capacity, they'll try and support the family to try and come up with some solution for the child if the child is ill. So really, I suppose, the point of the notices, or when TUSLA actually takes legal action, it's when they see there is a really good reason why they have to intervene to try and get the child into school. And it's because of this, the massive implications for a child when they're not in school attendance. If you look at what children talk about, what's most important for them about school, they always say friendship. And not attending school means they miss out on those connections. But it also means, you already cited research already, like the impact on literacy, numeracy, their life chances in terms of employment opportunities and educational opportunities. I mean, they'll never reach their full potential if they have a huge interruption in their schooling.
So what are the steps we can take today to, I guess, aid parents who their child's school attendance is not the top priority on their life list?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things where we know, when you go a bit deeper, some parents will say they're concerned about bullying and what's going to happen for their children in schools. And that has happened with some of the traveller families. And they hear about the experience their child is having in the school, and they don't want their child to be subjected to that. So I think we need to make a real effort to try and address what's happening in school life, which means that children aren't attending. I mean, you mentioned mental health, and the TUSLA would have data, and it's very clear from some of the stats that when there's poor mental health facilities or poor CAMHS facilities in a regional or a local area, you actually do see a drop in school attendance. So, it really, there are other issues why children aren't attending school, and you find when children are really suffering from significant emotional disturbance or mental health issues, they find it very hard to step outside the front door. They find it very hard to hang out with their friends, and they find it exceptionally hard to go to school and do all the things that they're meant to do at school. So I do think all of those things need to be looked at. But I really feel with the event of COVID and just the huge level of interruption in children and young people's lives, I do think there's going to be a need to look at having more alternatives to mainstream school to make sure nobody slips through the net. We have a situation in Ireland where there are some great alternatives to school, where children are doing really well and young people are doing really well.
So, Tania, give me some examples to these alternatives. Yeah. Or for
the Life Centre in Cork is working with young people who may have left school for a particular reason. There's Citywise in Tallaght.
So sorry, Life Centre in Cork, working with people, what exactly do they do day to day? Just give me a bit more detail.
So what they're doing day to day, and there's been really good research documenting what they do, is they take a person-centred approach, basically. So when a young person starts in their centre, so they're teaching the curriculum, they're teaching. They might be doing the Leaving Cert or doing the Leaving Cert Applied, so they're teaching it as it is. But when the young person arrives, they take a person-centred approach, and they talk to them about what they want to get out of education. And there's a lot of emotional support for them as well. They'll also make sure, that there's a meal every day. I've been down there myself, and they have high aspirations for the young people as well. And that's one of the things you hear for young people when they talk about school, who often who drop out. Sometimes they get discouraged in school. And there'll be low expectations from some of the teachers, or sometimes young people can have very complex emotional needs. They could have been dealing with a very difficult situation in their home life, and it can be difficult for schools to provide them with the kind of support that they need, and they need to go somewhere alternative like the Life Centre where they can get that kind of one-to-one support to get them through the curriculum.
Tanya, I'm going back here to the Citizens Information website, and it notes about enforcement in terms of absenteeism. And TUSLA can arrange for an examination of a child's intellectual, emotional or physical development, it's noted here, with consent of the parents. With the experience you have, with the knowledge you have, do you think that is happening enough throughout Ireland's education sector?
I mean, I do wonder about, I suppose, our attendance records in general, because what I have heard from people working within this particular area where children are dropping out of school and young people are dropping out is sometimes registers aren't kept up to date. And TUSLA mightn't hear about a young person dropping out of school maybe for 2, 3 or 4 months. And I do think there's a need to really look at, well, actually what is really happening, because our overall statistics look good. I mean, they look pretty good in contrast to other European countries. But on the ground, though, you see there are some young people that are slipping through the net, and they mightn't be referred to TUSLA. And the other problem is there mightn't be something like the Life Centre available for them in their local community. We hear this all the time. We have an information helpline in the Children's Rights Alliance, and we've led free legal advice clinics. And we do hear a lot from parents and children and young people about the lack of just options for them. Because really what you want to do is provide them with the best options to help them get the most as they can out of the education system and then go on to reach their full potential.
Well, I appreciate your time this afternoon. That is Tanya Ward. She is the Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, speaking about school attendance there. So TUSLA has sent warning letters to nearly 3,000 parents in the past 7 years for not sending their children to school enough. Thank you so much, Tanya. Clinical Director of Therapy Institute, Systemic Family Psychotherapist and school teacher Richard Hogan joins me now. Hello, Richard.
Good morning, Ciara, or good afternoon,
Ciara. Good morning. Just out of the bed, are we, Richard?
It's been a long morning.
It feels like this week kind of has been long, actually. I do agree with you there. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Good stuff. Listen, you are writing in the Irish Examiner, as you do often, and the headline of this one is it right prescribing heavy medication to teenagers? You, your first three words are Latin, I believe.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no clue how to pronounce them. But basically, the Hippocratic Oath that is taken by doctors before they practice medicine is first, do no harm. You say, over the years, I have really struggled ethically with how quickly the teenagers I met in my clinic were prescribed heavy medication before they came to see me. So my first question to you is, I'm a parent of, would say, a teen, obviously, and I'm bringing them to the GP. They're suffering from anxiety. Would say the GP says, I'm pretty sure you know this is anxiety. Here is a contact detail for Richard Hogan or whatever therapist it may be. But before that, I'm going to put you on ABC type medication because I can see you're very much anxious and at risk of not being able to lead a normal life day to day, I guess. So that is before they even get in the door speaking to a therapist. Yeah. Is that what you believe shouldn't be happening as much?
I think what we're seeing here is a huge issue. I think we've got the perfect storm here, Ciara. I think that's what is occurring currently, in my estimation, what I've seen over the last 10 or 15 years, massive surge in children being prescribed heavy psychotropic drugs. And we have to look, and I have to caveat this by saying, of course, for some children and for some adolescents, medication will ameliorate a biological disturbance. And that's important caveat. That will happen if you take a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor if there's a biological disturbance. But in my experience, Ciara, that's looking at the chemical imbalance. And what I see is it's an environmental imbalance. It's an imbalance in the child's ecology, in the family, in the school, in their peer group. And a medication isn't going to fix that. Medication perhaps might numb that experience, but it's not going to fix it. And it's really important as parents that we stand in the gap here. And I think we're too easy and we're too quickly to go to medication for an issue that might be the normal ups and downs, because we all feel anxiety at times. We all get low at times, and they're just a normative. They're just the slings and arrows of life. And we have to help our children to become more resilient and manage those things. And so I'm not saying that medication shouldn't be prescribed, but in most cases, and I would say 99% of cases that I've met over my long experience working in schools and more recently in clinically as a psychotherapist, I would say that we are too quick to roll out medication, and we have to be careful because once these things go into our children's brains, you know, they disrupt synapses.
Okay, so you mentioned SSRIs there, right? A lot of people won't know what they are. Would you define them as heavy drugs?
I would, yeah,
okay.
I would.
So
I would.
Go into the description of an SSRI and give me some uses of it.
Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors get in there and they move around with serotonin, you know, one of the mood regulators. And so if it's going to go in there and impact on your processing of serotonin, you want to be very careful about how you do that and about when you do that with your child. And there's a glaring presupposition, and I think maybe perhaps an impecunious or a false presupposition is that there's a biological disturbance here. And so that's the presupposition that I'm saying that we need to look at. Look at what the child that you're coming to the doctor with. Look at what's disturbing them. And look at what the rupture is.
So this is my... I just want to stop you there because would say if a parent is bringing... the parent has brought the child, right, would say to the GP, right? And there is something in the environment that is going wrong. But the parent obviously wants their child to feel better. So they're going to follow the advice, would say, of the GP or maybe even a psychotherapist who administers or gives a prescription for these type of drugs.
Sure.
The parent at many times is going to feel, if they don't have a background in psychotherapy or anything to do with that or medicine, they're going to feel like this person knows best, so I'm going to follow their advice. And as well, sometimes with the environmental situations, the parent themselves may be being affected by it also and may not be exactly thinking balanced or straight when it comes to this and being able to step in, as you note, and say, this is not the best thing for my child right now.
Yeah, first of all, I would say psychotherapy, psychotherapist wouldn't prescribe medication. That would be psychiatrist or a clinic.
Psychiatrist. Apologies.
I know it's a bit of a nuanced thing, but there is...
complete difference. Yeah.
And I would listen to my psychiatrist, you know, I would listen to the psychiatrist and I would say, that's where we kind of, you know, if you go to your GP, I think you need to, if there is an issue there and they're saying you need to be prescribed medication, I would say I would go to a psychiatrist and get that evaluation. And that would be important. But my point is that what I'm saying is that, you know, there's been a huge surge here, Kira, massive surge in mental health issues. And we have to look at the data and say, you know, all the promotion in schools, all the mental health awareness, is that helping the situation here? Is that helping to ameliorate things here for teenagers? Or is it in some ways endorsing it? And we've got the perfect storm here. We have problems in CAMHS. We haven't got the proper talent acquisition going in there. Psychiatrists, we saw what happened in Kerry. And so, we've got long waiting lists for children to see psychiatrists and to see multidisciplinary teams. And so often the first step here is, because of the massive backlog, is to just go on an SSRI. And I'm just saying to parents, in my experience, be careful before you do that. Of course, in some cases, that will be very important for your child if they have a biological disturbance. But, you know, the majority of what I see, it's not a biological disturbance. It's an environmental disturbance. And so you have to look at, you know, getting to somebody and talk therapy first before you start going to medication.
What's really interesting in your article is that you say up until the 1990s, clinicians and researchers had assumed that children and adolescents didn't experience depression.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and so, you know, these labels that we describe mental dysphoria, they weren't discovered, they were created. And we have to be careful and we have to think about the social construction around mental dysphoria. And we have to think about the messaging. And what I see here in my work in schools for over 20 years, there's a lot of this talk about it's okay not to be okay, you know, it's okay not to be okay. And that's a good message. That's about not taking the stigma out of mental health. And that none of us want to go back to the dark ages where we didn't talk about mental health. But I think we also have to give the message, it's okay to be okay. And I often wonder, are we teaching our children how to thrive? Are we teaching them how to really experience joy in their lives and how to understand that when you get low, that's normal and that's okay and that you'll come out of it, but you have to at times work your way out of it and that a tablet isn't the answer to this thing. And often, you know, this is why I suppose it's, I think currently the mental health situation globally is like the diet situation in the 90s. There's a lot of people involved in it who are just trying to monetize everything. And you can't monetize talking about someone's environment and helping them to work out of the depression. It's much easier to monetize something like Zoloft or Lexapro, and there's a $1 trillion industry around that. And we just as parents have to be careful about, and understand that is a thing.
Richard, the massive surge, why do you think this surge has happened?
I think it's a very important conversation, Ciara, and I think it's a multifaceted situation. But what I would say is we've got the perfect storm. I think the mental health messaging in schools isn't helping the situation.
Okay,
I think
expand on that bit a little bit.
I think if you're going to any school or university, it's the messaging, the posters all over the walls and everywhere will be all about mental health, and it will all be about quite, it won't be positive, it'll be very negative. And there's lots of talks around, self-harm and cutting and, eating disorders. And so if you sit down with any group of teenagers are incredibly suggestive. If you sit down with any group of teenagers and you suggest something to them, like say, I often do this as a bit of research and I suggest something to them. And afterwards I see, has that suggestion been taken on? Let's say if I say to them, if you get a pain in your toe, that could be the sign of a blood clot and you possibly could die from that. If I interview them at the end of that conversation, there'll be at least five or six and say, I have a pain in my toe. We're incredibly suggestive. And so if we have very negative messaging put all over the place and that's reinforced, I think that what can happen is teenagers begin to think that if I don't have a mental health issue, I might be just ordinary and dull. And that's not an attractive identity for a teenager. And we have to be very careful that we're not endorsing it. And so when we bring people into the school environment to talk about the mental health condition that they've had, let's say, a minor celebrity that comes into the school. And if I was 15 and I loved the Beatles and Paul McCartney came into the school telling me about his mental health condition, am I more likely to have a mental health issue that Paul McCartney had or less likely to have that? And so what we need to be is very careful of the people we bring into the school. And of course, we need people to come and talk about what they've experienced, but we need to help students to work. It needs to be a positive message, how you work out of it, how you come out of depression, how you manage your life. It's not just about having it, because that's making it kind of like cool. And we have to be very careful around the messaging.
Richard, what about if people are trying to come off SSRIs? What would you say to anybody listening that they feel themselves are a bit worried about this and they want to make a change?
Well, you'd never do anything willy-nilly. I mean, you don't ever do anything rapidly coming off an SSRI.
Because some people listening to this, it may, worry them.
No, it shouldn't worry them at all. It should just make them, more cognizant, maybe. If there's parents listening to this, make them more cognizant about, how they take the advice from professionals. And if someone's thinking about coming off an SSRI, they have to do that very slowly. They have to go back to their GP, link in with the GP, and come off that very slowly. But again, you'd have to, you'd have to be talking to your psychologist, and your GP would need to be something that's done and managed very well.
Okay, listen, I really appreciate your time this afternoon. It's a really interesting article in the Irish Examiner that Richard has written. And as he notes, which I think is one of the most interesting parts, is that up until the 1990s, clinicians and researchers had assumed that children and adolescents didn't experience depression. He notes there, with influencers and, maybe celebrities in teenagers' lives who may be speaking about their own personal struggles, whether it's, mental health or whatever else in their life. Would you be more, or could you see your teen being more influenced by this? If you think back to yourself being a teenager, maybe the answer to this is obviously yes, says many of you. So the article is Richard Hogan, Is It Right Prescribing Heavy Medication to Teenagers? It's in the Irish Examiner. If you head to lifestyle section of that website, Health and Being, and click on that, and it's one of the first few stories. Thank you so much. You always have a great time for us here, Richard, Clinical Director of Therapy Institute, a systemic family psychotherapist and school teacher, Richard Hogan. The 2022 steam run from Kildare to Cork is taking place tomorrow. That is the 28th of May, and it is in aid of the Irish Wheelchair Association. I have Sean O'Gorman on the line. He is a member of the Irish Steam Engine Owners Association. Hi, Sean.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
So tell us, what is happening tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow we are setting off with about 10 steam engines from Tokers and Naas about 11 o'clock, and we're aiming to reach halfway in Cork, which is out on the Bandon side of Cork, about this time next Friday. So the engines will leave. They travel slowly, and we'll go through Newbridge, Kildare, Monastrevin tomorrow, and we'll end up tomorrow night at the Heath in Port Leash, and that'll be our overnight. So we do about 20, 25 miles a day, and we're hoping to raise plenty of money along the way for the Irish Wheelchair Association.
And at what speed do you do this?
Ciara, the engines range from between 4 and 10 miles an hour. We try to average about between 3 and 4 miles per hour on average on the road.
Wow.
So, we're not going anywhere fast.
No, you're definitely not. But as you're noting, it is passing through the county tomorrow. So Newbridge, Kildare Town and Monastereven ending up in Port Laois tomorrow evening. The first team run, it was held in 2000 and the Irish Wheelchair Association was the first beneficiary. And since then, it's noted here in your press release that the steam run has raised thousands of euro for Irish charities and obviously brought delight to the towns it has run through. So again this year you're teaming up with the Irish Wheelchair Association and people can donate on the day to the fundraiser, but you can also donate online and text as well, Sean.
That's right, yeah, we have an iDonate. There's several methods of donation online and whatever, you know, through the Wheelchair Association. Yeah, so on the streets and in the towns there will be collectors, I think, collecting money as well. So we encourage everybody to come out and bring their mothers and fathers and grandfathers and grandchildren out and to see the steam engines. It's getting to be a rare occasion now, driving steam engines along the road, so it's great. They all have their living vans with them. That's where they sleep. They'll be sleeping in their vans, their living vans on the road. So we're self-sufficient. We go down the road, taking our time. We stop when we get down into the country on Monday. We generally, in some of the towns, we'll stop and get the kids out of the schools to see the vehicles and let them get up and experience the steam, you know. So it's going to be great fun.
Well, idonate.ie/teamruniwa2022. That is the website where you can donate, donating to the Irish Wheelchair Association, as I mentioned. And supporters can also text WHEEL, W-H-E-E-L, to 50300 to donate €4. So it's the 2022 steam run from Kildare to Cork tomorrow. It starts and tomorrow it will be passing through Newbridge, Kildare Town and Monastereven. So if you can donate, the advice is to please do so in aid of the Irish Wheelchair Association. And that is Sean O'Gorman, a member of the Irish Steam Engine Owners Association. Thanks, Sean. Now, you may have heard on our morning newspaper review on Kildare today that the nation's oral health is at risk. That's because children are not seeing a dentist until their teens, in particular until they get to secondary school. I have the chief executive of the Irish Dental Association on the line. That is Fintan Horahan. How are you today, Fintan?
Thank you, Ciara.
Well, thank you for joining me. So you have called this situation incomprehensible. How is this the case?
Well, we have a shortage of dentists on the one hand and a huge number of people waiting for dental care on the other. So with respect to children, there is a service run by the HSE staffed by dentists, which is there to cater for children. In theory, children should be seen by the HSE dental service at second, fourth and sixth class, or at least at three different intervals during their primary school years. But because of a shortage of dentists, many are not now being seen until secondary school. And, you know, that is incomprehensible. I was astonished when I was told it at a recent meeting with members in the HSE dental service. And I suppose this reflects a bigger problem, which is a shortage of dentists both in the HSE and in private practice generally.
Why the shortage of dentists in this country?
Well, we're not producing enough graduates, for one. We have two dental schools which would graduate about 90 dentists every year, of whom 70 would go on to register here. The other 20 will go back to Canada or the Middle East. We don't have enough dental school places. We have many dentists who come to Ireland from overseas, for which we're very grateful. So in total, we have 200 dentists join the register every year. But still, you're aware that there are big waiting lists for private patients, for medical card patients. So we clearly don't have enough dentists here in Ireland. And it's part of a bigger problem worldwide, I suppose.
And then, Fintan, why such a high number of children waiting?
Well, children are seen by the HSE. Obviously, they can see their private dentists as well, but many people are familiar with the HSE service where they go to schools and they screen children at an early stage. So over the last decade, the number of children under 16 has increased by about 25%. the number of dentists in the service to see them has fallen by about 25%. So you can see straight away that there's a failure to keep up with the rising numbers of children, patients, and the public service simply hasn't got enough dentists to take on that work. And equally, you're aware there are problems in the medicine card scheme, and many of the dentists in the HSC are now being diverted to cater for some adults in some cases.
You were noting there the medical card scheme when it comes to dentistry. I've had you on before speaking about this, and you are noted as saying that currently the medical card system has basically collapsed in terms of, dentistry in this country.
Yeah, so there's about 1.5 million adults are entitled to dental care under the medical card scheme. As I've said previously, the scheme has collapsed because dentists, all of whom hold individual contracts, have said they can't continue with the scheme. They have many concerns with the scheme about the limitations on the treatments they can provide, limitations on the materials that they can use, limitations on the techniques, and the fact that the fees that they're paid aren't enough to cover their costs. So, you know, it's little surprise. Many of them stayed with the scheme for far longer than might otherwise have been expected. They were hoping that the Department of Health would eventually recognise that there has to be an entirely new scheme. That hasn't happened. We've had promises that talks will start in the second quarter, which is nearly up. So, you know, there's no sign of any sense of urgency on the part of the Department of Health to actually address that problem.
Now, you have noted that about 200 dentists, new dentists, that is, would be added to the register each year, which was supposed to be the situation, with 70 Irish registered dentists added to the list on average. So you can see the discrepancy there that Fintan was speaking about in terms of the population of people under the age of 16. That has grown by about 25%, as Fintan just said, in the past 15 or 20 years. And the number of dentists has also been hit by 25%, but that's a decrease. So the obvious discrepancy there. Thank you so much for joining me, Chief Executive of the Irish Dental Association, Fintan Horahan. Thank you for your time this afternoon. You always have great time for us here on KFM.